accession number 205 78 reel 3.
Johnny M's reel 3.
Yes, unload the guns and ammunition onto the wharf side, and the Germans, as usual, were quick to respond, and the bombers arrived, and bone was used for the export of phosphate, which is converted into fertilizer, rock phosphate. And the bombs landed in these great heaps of this brownish powder, and the mess was unbelievable. Luckily, they didn't hit us or the Queen Emma, or whatever she was. We had no transport at all. We just had the men and the guns and the ammunition. Captain Gunn went off into Bone and commandeered three lorries. They were driven by, I think it's called producer gas. You have a charcoal fire on the back and that produces a gas which works the engine. And they towed us out to Bone Aerodrome, which is 2 or 3 miles to the east of Bone. And we go across the aerodrome, got shot at by some Messerschmitts as we went, because the Messerschmitts didn't like the aerodrome either, and set ourselves up right in the middle of the aerodrome. The land there is very flat. It had been a marsh some years ago. It's easy to dig in to make slit trenches for our protection. The parachutists had landed in the morning, and they were on the sand dunes, which separated the aerodrome from the sea. And there we sat. We got bombed. Fortunately, it was a Junkers 88. It came so low, it released its bombs over us. But they hadn't primed, and they just went into the marshy stuff and didn't detonate. But we did a good thing. We had a gunner ball with his Bren gun, who was our anti-aircraft gunner, and he actually shot this plane down, and it landed and spread itself across the aerodrome. It was interesting because, from my point of view, it was very nice. I got a plastic bit of seating, which was very useful for me. And we got some papers from the pilot's body, which we gave to the RAF. And from that, they were able to find that the squadron had been... The papers included something to do with a theatre or a nightclub in a French city. And from that, they were able to find that a certain squadron had moved from Europe to Africa, or actually not to Africa, to Sicily. And so they did get some valuable information. We sat on the aerodrome there for a day or two, and then the rest of the battery with the vehicles caught us up, and off we moved eastward. Now, obviously some staff officer had looked at the map of North Africa and saw Sahara Desert and hot. So we were equipped with khaki drill, little bush shirts and khaki shorts. And we moved eastwards, I on my motorcycle. And it wasn't long before we were in the foothills of the Atlas Mountains, and there was 4 inches of snow, not sand at all. My God, it was cold. I remember going, in fact, I was only half awake, and I drove into the back of one of our gun towing vehicles, but I wasn't hurt. On we pushed eastwards until we came to a little town. We crossed from Algeria into Tunisia, and we came down to a little town called Beja. Beja, and the parachutists had landed the day before, I think at Sukalaba or Sukalchemist, and they'd marched into Beja, and we were there to support them. And again, there were the Germans busy bombing, and life was very difficult. You didn't move about in the daytime, or you were straight away in trouble. We moved from Beja to a farm about 3 miles out called Bellefontaine, and there we hid. We moved at night, and the officers lived in the farmhouse, and the men lived in the farm buildings. French farmer with Arab staff, and the men were ordered that they, whatever happened, they did not go outside the buildings in daylight, because retribution came in the form of 2 ME-109s we called Gert and Daisy, and they shot you up, and then the bombers came and dealt with you, because the Germans had absolute 100% air superiority. The farm name came to be known as Flea Farm, because the first evening the men came to me and said, just look at this, sir. They were absolutely alive with fleas. And I went down to see the buildings, and the straw rustled as I went in there with the with the number of fleas. You know, this is just part of the filthy life of soldiering. We were there for a day or two, and then we moved off. We went through a village called Medjez el Bab, heading towards Tunis, and we very nearly got to Tunis. Some of the infantry could actually see the rooftops in Tunis. We got to a place called Tabouba, a village which, I don't know, 12, 15 miles from Tunis, I think. And there we bumped into the Germans good and proper. And I remember our guns, our little 3.7 howitzers, which were designed to shoot up Afghan tribesmen, were put in an anti-tank roll in a place called Chuigi Gap, which was, we're right on the edge of the Atlas Mountains here, and the river and the railway and the road went through this Chuigi Gap, and we had to cover the gap against German tanks. My section of two guns was facing right over the river, to see if they came that way, and Russell Matthews, his section facing left over the road and railway, and we got attacked with, I think it was 26 German tanks. There was a troop of British 25-pounders, the other side, about half a mile away. The extraordinary thing was, this was the first time our soldiers had been in action. We'd just had the infantry streaming back through us in a considerable state of disarray. And there are these 26 tanks coming, Mark 3s and Mark 4s. A terribly alarming sight, and yet the men just stuck there. And this was a result of discipline. And when they got to within 900 yards, we started banging off at them. And six tanks out of the 26 were destroyed. Three were credited to our little guns. The other three went to the 25-pounders. And the German tanks didn't like this. They were very silly. They didn't bring any infantry with them at all, because the infantry could have dealt with us. We had no infantry cover at all. The tanks withdrew out of gun range. We could see them there, and that was the end of the battle. But it was mighty exciting while it lasted.
Who were these infantry who were coming back?
The infantry were the Northamptons. They were part of, I don't know which brigade of 78 Div, but I mustn't say they panicked, but they were in complete disarray when they came through the gun position. And our men saw this and then saw these tanks and stuck it.
Yeah. What was your role at the time of
I was a gun position officer. I was in charge of the two guns of my section. And as I say, I was guarding the right-hand side of the pass, not the left. The tanks, from my point of view, came to the left-hand side. And from my position where I was, I couldn't shoot at them. They were not in my field. My orders were to guard that side, and that's all I had to do. And Russell Matthews, who had got the most of it, because we got all the overs and all the machine guns. There was no end of stuff flying about. Then we withdrew back to Medjez el Bab. This took place on the last days of November 42, the action at Chuigi Gap. We went back into Medjez el Bab, and as far as I remember, it was a period of comparative quiet. There was a lot of patrolling and fighting in the foothills, and we supported this, but there was nothing spectacular. The next spectacular thing was, I think it was Christmas Eve, 1942. We had, in our withdrawal, we had surrendered what appeared to be a terribly important feature called Longstop. This was a great big mountain stuck out into the valley, and it struck me as being terribly important militarily, but we abandoned it, and the Germans took it gratefully. And on Christmas Eve 1942, it was decided that this had got to be retaken, and it was a battalion, I think, of the Grenadier Guards. 78 Division had 11 Brigade, 36 Brigade, and a Guards Brigade. And I think it was the Grenadier Guards had the job of attacking this thing, and it was a most unpleasant job. They took the place, handed it over to the Americans, who promptly lost it again. And that, I wasn't involved thereafter.
The What did you see of that fighting yourself?
I saw nothing of it. I wasn't in it. Our other section was, they were involved in it, but I wasn't actually involved in it, fortunately. The feature by now in Tunisia was the mud, and you simply couldn't get off the hard roads. Otherwise, the vehicles bogged and you were stuck. At some stage about this time, I do remember going to a Roman bath, because the Romans had occupied this country 2,000 years ago, to a Roman bath near Bija, which was interesting. There it was, this original Roman building with lovely warm water bubbling up, and we all had the opportunity of cleaning ourselves up. But the fighting, then, it was after Christmas, it was all, from our point of view, pretty small-scale stuff. We did spend some time on odd days going out into the plains between the Atlas Mountains and the sea, very flat country, carrying out patrols. They'd send a section of our guns, two or three armoured cars, and a Bofors anti-aircraft gun, and we'd go out and just show ourselves. I think really to try and fool the Germans into thinking that we were stronger than we were. Fortunately, on these things, we were totally exposed and very vulnerable, but we were never attacked by good luck. But the fighting was mostly small-scale stuff in the hills. We're supporting various infantry battalions. Very tiring, very wearing, but not particularly bitter fighting. But in February, I was involved in a very tricky operation, where the British were holding a line roughly from Medjez el Bab up to Jebel Abiad, and it was a line of hills and mountains. It's not a continuous trench line such as you had in the First World War. We held odd strong points, and the Germans were the same. And sticking out into a place called Sidi Nasir, about 10 miles in front of the line, was a battalion of the Hampshire Regiment and 155 Battery. I couldn't say which field regiment they came from. And their job was to act as an outpost and as a warning, because we knew the Germans were going to attack us, because they'd been busy down in the south around Kazreen, and we were pretty thin on the ground. And this was the Hampshires and the 155 Battery were to act as a delaying force. And I was lent to 155 Battery. Their position was so vulnerable, they're stuck out, literally on a limb, 10 miles out in the country, and they simply hadn't enough subalterns to man all the OPs that they needed to man to perform their job. And so I was ordered to go and report to them. I went on my motorbike in the night, and going up the road to Sidi Nasir, I got stopped by a sentry and reported into their wagon lines, where all their vehicles were parked. And I was told there that you can't take your motorbike any further forward, you've got to walk. And they were incredibly surprised that I got there, because the Germans have been in the habit of patrolling at night between their wagon lines and our main lines, and they were very surprised I hadn't been picked up in my innocence. I'd just ridden up there. So I walked up and I got onto the battery position, found the battery commander, reported to him, in the middle of a usual attack from two ME-109s, which were shooting up the battery. And he explained to me that I was to go and find a platoon of the Hampshires, which were back on the side of the road up which I'd come. And I went back and I found them. And then there was a lot of firing from the gun position, which was about 2 miles. I was about 2 miles from the gun position. A lot of firing there. And it transpired that German tanks, including the Mark VI, the Tiger, the real dreaded one, had attacked 155 Battery. And this tremendous battle took place between the tanks and the guns. I saw, to a gunner officer, was a wonderful target of a German column of guns and vehicles moving very slowly along a track, easily within range. And I gave fire orders, but the gun said, "No, you know, we're so busy trying to keep the tanks off, we can't take this target on." And this battle went on, and by evening, every gun had been destroyed, and the Germans had overrun the position.
Can you give any more details about that?
No, from my position, I couldn't see the firing. You see, I'm 2 miles away, and there was a little little bump of a hill or something in between me and the guns. I could hear it all, but we didn't know what was happening. But then the firing died down, and the subaltern who commanded the infantry platoon said to me, he'd had message over his wireless that the place had been overrun and that we were to make our way out at night. And so he and I consulted the map, and we could see that by going down the slope, down the hill on which we were stationed, across the road up which I'd come, continuing along a track, we would come to a road which went to Jebel Abiad, and there, from there we could get out all right. And so this we did. We waited until it was dark, and about 1 o'clock the subaltern came to me and said, we were moving now. He said, unfortunately, the German tanks have come on, and they're occupying the road just where we've got to go across. They are spaced apart, but, you know, we literally got to go between them and make our way across the road into this track, which we did. It was a bit worrying walking past these ruddy tanks at 20 yards, just quietly walking across the road. The Germans were very silly. They'd put no sentries or guards out. I think they thought they'd completely destroyed the whole thing, and there was no British there. We literally walked between these tanks and formed up the other side, and I'd got my two gunner signals from 155 battery, and I led the party out, found my way along this track, and the subaltern of the infantry followed with his lot until we got to the Jebel Abiad road, and there was an armoured car standing, and they sent the message back, and lorries came and picked us up and took us back and sorted ourselves out. But it was a very alarming day one way or another. But I was lucky. I wasn't actually involved in any of the fighting there. But the battery commander, I forget his name now, he got a military cross for it. And he died quite recently. I saw his obituary in the Daily Telegraph. But it's one of the days I remember. It was a very hard day. Then I rejoined my battery. And I can't remember, nothing, there was nothing much outstanding after that. We were involved in a place called Green Hill and Bald Hill. They were two hills which stood astride one of the roads which led from the British lines to Tunis or Bizerta. Very, very unpleasant fighting there.
In what sense was it so unpleasant?
The weather conditions were awful. The mud is unbelievable, Tunisian mud. The fighting itself wasn't pretty hard. It was unpleasant. We exchanged. We got shelled and we shelled back and we got mortared and so on. I had an OP on the forward slope overlooking the enemy. I had a wonderful view. The Germans occupied these two hills, Green Hill and Bald Hill, and I used to have to get into my OP before it was light. I and my signaler gunner Bell. And there we sat, literally, from the moment it got light until it got dark, and we couldn't smoke because we were in full view of the enemy. We've got some bushes that had been put in front of it just to hide out directly from them, and we had to stay there and eat our meals and perform our bodily functions in this hole in the ground. At night we withdrew down the hill to a tunnel. The railway line was right underneath my OP, and the tunnel had been built there, and the infantry occupied the tunnel, and I used to come down there with my signaler and sleep at night. We had quite an alarming experience one night, because I would come up to relieve Lieutenant Birtwistle, and we were all of us in the tunnel, and the Germans managed to land a shell or a bomb right in the mouth of the tunnel at their end, and a great shower of sparks came along the tunnel surface, and John Birtwistle got nicked on the head. He was lucky it was only a nick, or there'd been nothing left of him. Another event I remember very plainly up at the tunnel. The fighting went on in Tunisia. Gradually we were getting more aircraft, and life became a lot less unpleasant. The ground dried up. Spring comes very suddenly from being all mud. The hills suddenly burst into lovely colours, a lot of gentian, wild gentian, they were quite blue. And the 8th Army, of course, by now had pushed up and joined us. And we were, by end of April, we were preparing to make the final push into the end of the fighting in Tunisia. And the next job I remember, which was rather unusual, we had been changed from our original 3.7s to 25 pounders for ease of ammunition supply, really. And now that we were out of the mountains largely, the 25 pounder was much more used. And our battery was used to fire a smoke screen, a continuous smoke screen for the whole of the daylight to shield the view from the German observation posts on a mountain called Jebel Buaukaz from the preparations which the British 1st and 8th Armies were making for the attack. Absolute monotonous job, banging off these things. I forget how often, about every 30 seconds, I think we fired a smoke shell. Then came the final attack on Tunis. I mentioned the Jebel Buaukaz. This was a great big mountain that stood astride the road to Tunis, and it was vital that this was taken. And the method here was, I can't remember the various infantry that were involved, because by now we got a tremendous number of infantry and guns. But from the artillery point of view, about 7 or 8 of us from all sorts of regiments were detailed as observation post officers to go up and get on these hills and prevent any counterattack. By now, the British artillery was highly organized, and any one of these OPs could call down fire of about 300 guns onto a target simply by using code words. They were their fish names, Haddock. If you called Haddock 5 rounds of gunfire, then 300 guns would fire 5 rounds each onto an area, not a target, an area. I don't know how big, 2 or 3 football pitches, if you like. I was selected for one of these jobs, and I set off with my signaler, Bell. And because of the nature of the country, the mountains are all rock and shale. It was quite impossible to dig a hole or dig an observation post. And so we were given a sergeant and 3 or 4 men from the Royal Engineers who brought up things called beehives. They're explosives designed for causing a blast which is very directional. If you hook them onto a pillars of a bridge, it'll cut a hole right through the pillar. We'd found that these, if you put them, 4 of them, about 4 on a square, on the corners of a 4-foot square, they would punch a wonderful OP hole for you, perhaps 5 foot deep, and you could get very quick cover. And so off we set with these, with my signaler and these engineers. The infantry had previously taken the hill. We were not part of the getting them onto the hill. We were entirely there to meet any counterattack, because time and again we'd found the British would manage to take a hill, and then the Germans would put in a colossal counterattack, and we couldn't hold the hill. So this was the answer, that we would have sufficient artillery to stop it. I got up onto the top of the hill. It was dark, but you know, there was enough light in the sky to see, and I selected my OP, and the engineers blew their beehives. And Bell and I settled ourselves in there. That was it for the night. And then in the morning, I'd chosen the most awful position, because about 15 yards away, there was a little heap of stones, which we came to call a sangha, and in it was a German sniper. They did this. They would withdraw from a hill and leave a few snipers. And luckily, the first shots weren't at myself or Bell, who'd got her heads up looking out, but at some of the infantry were close round, and there were a lot of casualties from this man, so I was forced to stick my head down, and I couldn't actually act as an OP officer for some time. Then the sniper started throwing hand grenades at me. He knew just where I was, because he could see my wireless aerial sticking up. This was alarming. They're not like British hand grenades. They're on a wooden stick, about 15 inches long, I think. I saw one of these things go sailing past, and and exploded. And he fired, well, he threw two or three of these. Luckily, didn't manage to hit us, but it was very alarming and made me keep my head down. And then one of the infantry called out, "Keep your head down, gunner, we've got a Piat." A Piat is a projectile infantry anti-tank, I think it's called. It fires a bomb of some sort at a tank. And I shout out, "Right," and there was a whistle and a bang and the sanger disappeared and the sniper was killed, so we were able to move about. He turned out to be one of the Hitler youth, about 15-year-old. It was a shame to see such a young fellow killed, but they were absolute fanatical. They were quite prepared to die. It didn't worry them in the least. But thereafter, I was able to perform a proper job and saw some German self-propelled guns and infantry forming up, ready for the counterattack. And our infantry said, "You know, come on, get on with it." So I managed to call. I didn't have all 300 guns, but perhaps 80 or 90 guns onto this target. Spectacular sight to see. There were four of these self-propelled guns. See these shells all bursting all round because it stopped at any counterattack and it stopped at the guns. We had a problem though, because one of the guns of my battery, strangely enough, had got. They'd set something wrong on the gun, or they were using the wrong charge. I don't know what happened, but one round would keep landing right by us in amongst the infantry, and it made me very unpopular. And there I'm faced with this terrible decision that all junior commanders are in war. What are you going to do about it? Do you stop your firing at the enemy troops, or do you try and sort the problem out? And I thought, well, now we've just got to keep on. So we fired until the event was over. But whenever I hear now people killed by friendly fire, it's mighty difficult in action to sort these problems out. I, as a very junior officer, a lieutenant, had to make this appalling decision. Anyway, the hill was taken and the Germans collapsed. Most spectacular, from being tremendous fighting force. They literally collapsed within a couple of hours. And the battery moved forward on towards Tunis. I had a strange experience. I'm now in what's called an armoured OP. It's a Bren carrier, which is adapted for use by the artillery officers, because it was handy. It was bulletproof. It wasn't shellproof. It was bulletproof. And you could move about with a considerable degree of protection. Had a driver, myself, and two signals in it. We're going on this road, and one of the signals said, "Look, sir, there's some Germans in the cactus bushes." And I looked, and sure enough, there were. So I said to Signer Samuel, "Come with me with the Bren gun, and I'll go and see what this was, sir." With my revolver in my hand, I stride up to this cactus bush and shouting, "Don't shoot." And out came a German colonel, and he spoke very good English. And he said, why are you shooting?" It rather puzzled me. And he said, "You have a Red Cross." And of course, we had, the First Army had as its shield, a Red Cross. And there was I with a, it never occurred to me that this could be mistaken as the Red Cross of the REMC. And I explained the problem, and, all right, it was a casualty clearing station. And he said, "Right, we're your prisoners." And I said, "Well, there's nothing I can do. You just stay here and you'll get picked up." And he said, "Well, you might as well have my car." And it was one of the original people's car, the military version of the Volkswagen. And he said, "You can have my camera as well, because I know when I'm going to the prison camp, it'll be taken." So I accepted these two. And one of the gunner's signals drove this thing, and off we went and found the battery. I was slow. That night I left the German vehicle in our gun line with the other vehicles and with the camera in it, and during the night both were stolen, so I never benefited any of my ill-gotten gains from this thing. The fighting was finished and we moved on to a place called Infidelville. What we did notice was an enormous number of German rifles carefully stacked and piled, and somebody said, "For God's sake, don't touch them, they're all booby-trapped." And they were, this was the thing, there was a lot of danger. But the fighting was finished, and that was it. That was the end of the Tunisian campaign.
Did you get your decoration?
Yes, going up the Bou on this one when I went up, and the sniper was there. Yes. because I was wounded for the second time there. I was wounded three times altogether. Not serious. I remained at duty each time, but I got it, got my MC for that, yes.
What wounds did you actually get?
The first one was on the on long stop in my right elbow. This one up there was